At DockerCon 2016, the hot topic, other than containers, of course, that tends to dominate the enterprise architecture track is microservices. IronIO has been promoting stateless microservices-based architectures long before it was even fashionable, so we decided to get in touch with their CEO, Chad Aramura, and ask him about this symbiotic coupling. Our first question, how has microservices architecture and SOA evolved in this age of container-based development, testing, and deployment?
Microservices as an architecture has evolved a lot over the years. And, you know, it really was, it's kind of, we like to joke around and call it the next coming of SOA, because service-oriented architecture was all about connecting things by way of APIs or connecting by a common protocol, which at the time was often, you know, enterprise service buses, a little more complicated enterprise technology, and puts you into a box around an enterprise stack. So, for example, Oracle had SOA Suite, and IBM had its own ESB, and you were in a walled garden of SOA. The idea behind microservices and the reason that it's become so popular over the years is because we've now broken out of those walled gardens and we've created APIs around our applications, which can then communicate openly across the web and be able to essentially integrate and communicate with each other using standard protocols like HTTP and JSON and REST. From the beginning, we've been all about this next coming of SOA theme. In fact, I wanted to put it on the homepage in 2011, but my co-founder was anti the word SOA. He said, don't even say SOA because people are going to look at us like the old guard.
But what is it that creates this symbiotic pairing between container-based systems and a microservices architecture?
I mean, they both have benefits in their own right. And so I think that either technology is going to advance in parallel, but the pairing of the two is very nice because they fit really well together. Because a microservice is small enough to be able to containerize easily. I mean, if you take a large monolithic stack, for example, it's much harder to containerize those workloads because there's a lot more going on in this stack. Containers are better suited for lightweight workloads, for smaller applications, for ephemeral applications, for background jobs, for tasks. That's why there's a very nice pairing. In fact, there's a resurgence or there's an emergence of something called microcontainers that we've been talking about, which are keeping containers down to 30, 40 megs. And so that makes it very easy for them to be able to transport, and they're portable. There's not a whole lot of network overhead. And so you take the pairing of containers and you pair that with microservices, and you've got a portable microservice that can be deployed anywhere, any infrastructure, sort of on-prem, cloud, it's totally portable.
So whether it's speaking at KubeCon or DockerCon or Cloud Expo, or even just doing consulting with your own clients, what are the big trends that you're seeing in the world of microservices and containers and enterprise development as a whole?
What we're seeing at Iron, and this is a good sort of segue into some of the serverless things that we're seeing, the serverless trend is all about empowering developers to build applications without having to think about the infrastructure, without having to think about building for a specific server, for a specific server configuration, having to worry about the construct of a CPU or memory or network or bandwidth. They just build an application and it just runs and scales. Now, of course, there are still servers somewhere and there are still ops of that application. But the idea is to abstract as much away from the developer that's building the logic as possible and give them the tooling to be able to build applications without thinking about those underlying components.
So in this world of serverless systems, what types of tools are organizations using as part of their infrastructure, and what type of impact does this have on DevOps?
So we're seeing the emergence of the higher level services on AWS, like DynamoDB, that allow you to stand up a database and never have to worry about the operations, the physical infrastructure. And then you're seeing services like IronIO, where you can write a worker and deploy it and just have it scale automatically without ever thinking about the servers. And so when you say DevOps, Ops is always a part of the engineering team and shouldn't be like a let's throw it over the wall to deploy, but we should be working together to build scalable applications without even thinking about the underlying.
Now, with traditional SOA type of architectures, governance was a really big deal, especially with large organizations like banks and large retailers and insurance companies where they've got a large number of SOA-based services. But microservices are a little bit of a different game. How do organizations deal with the governance question when their software development teams are deploying everything as microservices?
You were seeing most of the innovation happening within within the business unit groups themselves. You know, we definitely hear of this thing like bimodal IT, where you have the historic legacy applications, the big CRM, ERP applications still running, the SAPs and the Oracles of the world. And the mission there is to govern and operate those applications, maybe move them to the cloud, but really we just need to keep the lights on. But then we have this other side of the house that's oftentimes building new applications. They're the ones that are innovating and delivering new features and functionality to the users of the enterprise. That's where governance, of course, is important. And enterprises are definitely trying to get their arms around how to incorporate a container strategy, how to incorporate a cloud strategy, how to empower developers to build and deploy software while still operating a governance model for the applications that the developers are building. And so it is a brave new world around governance. And so I think that's where tooling like IronIO comes in, or other applications that allow you to monitor and self-describe the infrastructure spend that you want to put forth for your applications, and then allow developers to self-serve within that model. The OpenStack, for example, or the various managed providers for AWS, where you're given a certain amount of infrastructure, and then you can build on top of that within the realm of the governance model that the enterprise has put in place. So to answer your question sort of more directly, it's definitely a brave new world for governance, but operating, bringing in the right tooling is key for enterprises to be able to manage what's going on inside its four walls.
Now, you've eschewed the traditional SOA-based stack to a certain extent, but at the same time, your organization provides sort of some of those fundamental services and maybe stack-based operations that organizations might need, you know, the caching systems and the message queues and things like that. So how do you square that circle where, you know, on the one hand, we want to move away from these types of stacks, but the other side of the coin is you're actually in there providing some of these almost stack-based services that are designed to help provide some of that fundamental plumbing that microservices need.
Yeah, I mean, what we're providing is a containerized way to run jobs at scale or to run functions at scale. And we provide a message queue service and a cache service, and there's other ways to obtain those types of technologies, but what we've done is build them in a very cloud-native way. In other words, we operate on top of any cloud, whether it's public or private, so it's multi-hybrid cloud, and out of the box, it just works on all the different infrastructures. And so you get job processing, you get distributed messaging, all based on a REST API, talking over HTTP, JSON, which are the common web protocols now. And so you don't have to use like your traditional enterprise service buses or SOA suite models or BEPL process engines or that really complicated stuff that enterprises, it was hot for a while, but it's, at the end of the day, it's just too much to build new applications, and developers don't want to deal with the overhead of that stuff. So we look at ourselves as like a modern-day services-oriented architecture almost, except that we communicate with other APIs, and because it's all standards-based.
Now, I noticed that a lot of your systems are written in Golang. What made you decide to go with Golang, and isn't that a little bit of a trepidatious decision given the fact that, you know, it's relatively new and Google sometimes has a history of discontinuing support for new projects?
So that's an easy one. when we chose to start writing in Golang, was probably about 2011 or 12. I mean, we're talking like before pre-Go 1.0. And it really came down to my co-founder and I looking at the options, and we wrote them on a board, and we said, which one is nice to write, fast, and does not require the JVM, and we don't have to write JavaScript? And sure enough, only a couple came forward, and Go was one of them, and we said, you know what, let's go for it. No pun intended. And we went that direction, and the community was quite small in 2011. In fact, it was just an incubated project out of Google, a couple engineers internally there, brilliant guys, Rob Pike, and others who are some of the founding forefathers of modern-day computing languages. And they had a mission to build and design a very elegant language that was very usable and readable, and out came Go. And so we invested in it at the time. Since then, and it's now almost 5 years later, we actually run the Go SF meetup, the meetup tonight in San Francisco. We've watched the attendance and the interest and the marketability of Go just skyrocket over the years. So not only is it being supported and pushed by very brilliant, smart people inside of Google, but it has a bustling community growing around it. And we've been helping drive that community a lot by running the largest meetup in the world here in San Francisco. So even outside of Google's walls, we definitely see a lot of community support for it and positive motion for it.
So when does Go make the most sense as a programming language? What types of problems and applications is it best used for?
I mean, if you look at the list of companies that are using Go, it's like it's a who's who of companies. Like it is creeping its way into a standard language of almost every company that you can think about or you can name. And a lot of the popular use cases are generally things that are fast distributed systems, very, very fast network level, computer level systems programming are very well done using Go. Generally, not so much on like the I want to build a web application or I want to build like a Rails stack as quickly as possible. It's more like fast, high performance language, parallel processing, those types of things. So like quintessential example is building a load balancer, or building a network server, or building a queue service like ours. Like those are or building API servers. Like those are really popular use cases.
So we've kind of talked a little bit about sort of the high-level container and microservices architecture stuff. But with your organization, what is your play, and what does IronIO actually provide for enterprises?
Well, we are a serverless platform for job processing, so async job processing at scale. The three most common use cases that we find are data processing and ETL, so grabbing data from different APIs and doing some kind of a transform operation on them and loading them into a destination. Those are very popular because they're very asynchronous. And then related to that is web scraping and crawling, so grabbing things from websites, filling in data for comparison sites, comparison shopping sites, and various, it's sort of a different model of ETL. And then image processing, video encoding, asset processing. Those are that's another type of processing that we see is very heavy CPU based and requires a lot of compute power. And then one of the use cases, alerts and notifications, so sending out like massive number of alerts in a very quick amount of time. We can spin up processes across, let's say, 1,000 servers in less than a minute. And so the ability to send, for example, the news to your subscribers very quickly. Those are the pretty common patterns that we see.
Are you seeing IoT devices or even handheld smartphones really impacting your business model?
Yeah, we are definitely seeing some IoT use cases. The platform is very well suited for IoT because of the nature of how a message queue works. We can actually buffer data coming in from IoT devices. We have processors that can then process that data and push it into a data store or do analyzation or analysis on that data. Mobile is obviously a key part of everybody's digital strategy these days. And so whether it's processing data to push to a mobile device, processing an image that can be displayed on a mobile phone, processing an alert that goes out to a device, whether it's your push notification or SMS. They're definitely endpoints and pieces of the solution. But we've never been 100% focused on just, say, IoT or mobile.
So summing it all up, where are you seeing the big trends and where are you seeing the future of software architecture going?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing I'd want to say is that you've pretty much nailed the trends. What we're seeing is a confluence of those three trends. It's really around containers, serverless, and microservices. But I would say take it one step further and add multi-cloud. And if you take those four trends, a confluence of those trends, that's really where we're seeing software architecture go and where we're seeing the applications of the future being built. And if you architect them using those four trends, then you're really positioning yourself for a modern enterprise stack, I should say. And the tooling is becoming fantastic these days. You know, tools like Iron.io are making that a reality for enterprise and giving them back the control and the flexibility they need over their workloads, specifically around a multi-cloud strategy. And definitely, you know, anybody can find more information on our website, Iron.io. We've got plenty of information there about serverless trends. We're writing all the time on our blog, so Iron.io/blog is a key one. But it's exciting to see. We wrote an article all the way back in 2012 called "The Future is Serverless," if you can believe it. And we're now in 2014, 15, and 16, we've been seeing this trend just start to take off. And whether you think that serverless is the right term or not, the concept is not going away because developers are asking for ways to build and architect applications so they can stop thinking about the underlying plumbing. The abstraction layer is moving up. The value of these concepts to the enterprise is that they can deliver software faster to market. That's really what it comes down to. And be able to respond to market demands. And so that's really the market that we're tackling.